available on Amazon?
Yes, I think. Amazon or Feldheim Publishers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you got them for us initially, maybe.
Right, yeah, they're on sale. There might still be a Feldheim sale. Usually there is one around Hanukkah, and I think they may have possibly extended it. Okay. So ask them if you can get the set. All right, so today is the 14th of Tevet, January 9th, 2012, and we're going to do Mitzvot 234 to 236. So 234, not to honor an eminent person at a trial. So so it's interesting to think about, you know, the concept of blind justice is a Jewish concept, and it doesn't really exist in contemporary cultures at the time that justice should be absolutely blind. You know, landed people, white people, right, that should be objective. You know, slaves did not get the same justice, certainly not people with darker skin, or foreigners, or orphans, or widows, or anybody who could be taken advantage of, often was taken advantage of. But the concept that blessed justice should be blind and or objective is a Jewish concept, and it's throughout the Torah. So not to honor an eminent person in a trial. So even somebody who's a Talmud Chacham, a great scholar, or somebody who's accomplished their eminence on their own, not just that they have money or just that they have community stature, but that they have intellectual stature that's self-accomplished, they still should not be favored in a trial at all. And of course, he says that this is very clear, and the root purpose of the precept is known, and that I've written about in this parsha, so he writes about it really in the next one. But it's very clear that you need a system of justice and courts that work to keep a society functioning. So we've talked about that at length in other contexts. And Sandy's an attorney, so she helps us with the legal things and perspectives on that. So, but you'll see it's interesting in the next one. I'll have a question for you.
Okay. We'll see if I can answer it.
But it's clear that our societies have to run on law that works, that everybody can count on, that's just. And so the rule of law is important. and we see that not every society has that, and what happens to it.
Now, at this time, and really up until modern times, Jews were judged almost exclusively by a Beit Din for things that happened within the community.
Right.
Is that right?
Okay. That's right.
So they were only subject to, shall we say, secular systems when something like murder in the town occurred or that kind of thing, and that was not.
That's a good question,
fair.
But what's a secular system?
Well,
because were they secular?
In the Middle Ages, they weren't.
Yeah. Right.
I know in the Middle Ages, for sure, they weren't.
Right, so when do we start with secular courts?
Well, I don't know. Was that
the
during Elijah? The Enlightenment? That's what I was going to say.
I would
during
think it's in this country.
Well,
even in
no,
Europe
I think
before?
In France, during the Enlightenment and stuff.
In France.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would say in France, during the Enlightenment and all that. I think before.
Dreyfus case happened for that. It was late 1800s.
Yeah, I was thinking
right.
The 1800s.
Yeah, before that, I'm sure there were.
Right. I think that in Europe, I mean, I'm not saying it was only in America.
Persecution. Just, you know, Jews were drugged and burned.
And there was no punishment. I mean, it was okay.
Right.
It was all right.
Right. Right. I mean, there was some pretending that there was law and justice for many, but there. Yeah.
Well, initially, I mean, I think way back, you know, basically the rulers wielded, the rulers wielded all the justice,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then the church.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
I'll just look over his shoulder. You can keep it in front of you. It's fine. I can be silent.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it's. And now, really, the Beit Din is sort of relegated to people who are, you know, trying to deal with, quote, religious issues and
yes.
a few secular ones, like divorces and things like
right.
that are still...
So, right, so it's definitely used for religious issues, and people can go to that. And today, in this country, it could be considered binding arbitration.
Okay.
If you enter into it that way.
Okay.
So it is enforceable in that sense.
Oh, it is. So,
yes.
So you could take... If it was agreed by the parties, mm-hmm. you can take the decision of that entity to a secular court for enforcement.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
So
okay.
you can enter into contracts today
right,
that say any disputes will be taken to a Beit Din.
Just like you would a...
Mm-hmm. And often those Beit Dins, they're courts of three. So the way it works is each side picks one. And then the two of them together pick the third.
Which is pretty much frequently how arbitration is done. Interesting.
Right. Okay. So, right. So, but anyway, we do see that you need to have some kind of a system of enforcement that's fair.
But that's what all these things refer to as a bet din.
Right, of course. Yes, this is referring to a bet din. But also to, occasionally, the individual judge, as we'll see now in 235. So this is sheishpot betzedek, right? That you should judge, you should render judgment with righteousness. So this is for the bet din, but this is also for the individual judge. So that does happen sometimes, that there's an individual judge.
But we'll just read through. Things were judged by one person.
Okay, so let's talk about that in just a second, right? So first, to judge in righteousness, as it is stated, in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor, right? And I'll just say that in Hebrew because I'm sure you've heard it before, but just to, with the familiarity, to increase it. But tzedek tishpot et amitecha, right? To judge your neighbor with righteousness. But tzedek tishpot. So the concept of tzedek, right, as opposed to tzedakah, Tzedek is justice. Tzedakah is what we refer to in English as charity, but it's not. It comes from tzedek, justice. Tzedakah is justifying funds, making it justly distributed throughout the community, as opposed to charity, which is giving of your own stuff. This is just justifying the distribution. And the explanation was given that the judges were thus commanded to treat the contending parties equally. In other words, that a judge should not honor one of the parties in the lawsuit more than the other. So it was stated in the Medrash Sifra, which is a halachic Medrash, not a story Medrash, that one should not speak, that one should not speak as long as he needs, whereas the judge tells the other to shorten your words. So that's one of the examples of how you might favor somebody. Let one have the floor as long as they need, and the other one you'll just tell them, hurry up. and so our sages taught, in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor, that one should not stand and the other should sit. Right? One, it shouldn't look like one is being more respected. One speak is full need, whereas the other one is told, shorten your words. Likewise, included in this precept is the indication that every man who is learned in the laws of the Torah and honest in his ways is commanded to judge by the Torah's law between parties of a controversy if he has the power to do so.
Go ahead.
Right. So that's every man. It's not every woman. And learned and honest. So even if one individual person is able to judge by the law of the Torah, as the sages of blessed memory said, one person learned in the law may judge his fellow by the Torah's law, for it is stated, in righteousness shall you judge. So that's a different way to read it, right? First, you can read it, if you're judging, it has to be righteously. Mm-hmm. And the second way to read it is, you need to judge with righteousness.
So there would
so
be
judge. It's a positive commandment to judge.
There would be the argument of those people in Israel who are judging, which we all think is inappropriate, but
because no? That's in a court of law. The question, right? So it's not just you judge everybody walking down the street and do what you feel like. That is not the rule of law. That's vigilantism.
So this is, right.
Which
so
is
this
what's
is,
going on in
right.
Israel. Yeah.
So this is only in a court of law.
Yeah, may judge his fellow by the Torah's law. So court of law, what does that mean? You can set up a court of law. Right. Let's say I was a male, right, and you would come to me with a dispute right this minute, then I could enter the role of judge and judge the dispute, and this would be the court of law.
So like if Marlon and I had an argument and we came to you and we said, here's a problem mm-hmm. that we're
that
having.
That sets up the court of law. That's different than...
walking down the street. And
yes, mm-hmm. right. That's different than deciding that person needs to be egged and just doing it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
That's not. That is not judging. Right, and as you see here, it says, may judge his fellow by the Torah's law.
Yeah, right.
Not by what you feel like it should look like.
Yeah.
However, the sages cautioned that a man should not judge alone. So meaning you can judge alone, but it's not wise. It's risky to judge alone because you can easily be swayed or misjudged. So better you should take counsel with somebody else and it should be more than one judge. But it is possible to judge alone, and a person who is learned is required to judge if they're asked to. Because if they don't, where does it say that later on? right, so later on, just down the next paragraph, it says, towards the end of that paragraph, he needs a judge, for a learned and honest scholar will render true judgment, while if he who has the knowledge will not wish to act as a judge, other people who are not learned scholars will judge them, unwittingly perverting justice for one of the contending parties. So if you have the ability, you're required. Because otherwise you create space for people who don't have the ability.
Is this then the basis by which you ask a shaila of a rabbi?
Well, so a shaila is different. A shaila, a halachic query, a halachic question, that would be, you would ask a shaila because you don't know the answer and
right.
you want to make sure you follow right. So
as
that's
opposed
not judging.
To a dispute, okay.
Right, that's
okay.
not judging.
Okay, okay,
right?
okay.
It would
yeah,
be
yeah,
a,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It would be a dispute. So I'll give you an interesting for instance that I heard about in Cincinnati. So the rabbi of one of the Orthodox schools in Cincinnati, I was chatting with him, and he said he taught for Melton. And I said, oh, that's so nice. He says, yeah, a lot of people have come through my shul because of Melton. He said, actually, it was a problem because the conservative rabbi organized Melton, and he was not happy about how many Shabbos guests I had and how many people were coming to my congregation because of my teaching at Melton. So he said, we had a din Torah, right? He went to a court to discuss it, right?
Really?
So he said, let me take, the Orthodox rabbi offered to take the conservative rabbi to a din Torah to adjudicate this dispute. He's frustrated. You're teaching at Melton, and yet you're making people frum. I said, because I told him that my problem with Melton is that it's, that I had a hard time with it, is that it's teaching for literacy and I teach for inspiration. And it didn't work for me to not be able to teach for inspiration. Mm-hmm. You know, to teach just for literacy was very difficult and didn't click. So he said, well, he managed to swing the inspiration part and, you know, how many people were coming. How many people were coming to his, you know, congregation because of it. So he said he took the, he offered the conservative rabbi din Torah, and who did they choose as the adjudicator? He's telling me that he's proud of himself, the reform rabbi. They went to the reform rabbi because he felt like the conservative rabbi could trust him. He wouldn't feel like he's being taken to an orthodox rabbi who would say, of course you can be makar of these people, right? So he went to the reform rabbi. So they both present their case. So the conservative rabbi says, you know, I set up Melton, and, you know, his congregation is growing through my efforts. I don't think that's fair. So the reform rabbi said, so what are you doing? He says, they're my students, and I invite them for a meal in my house for Shabbos lunch. He said, well, that's what teachers do. That's fair. And then the conservative rabbi said, but then they go to his shul. He said, well, they're invited to the rabbi's house for lunch.
They're going to go to shul.
It's menschlich to go to shul. That's menschlichkeit. So it's Judaism to invite guests, and it's menschlichkeit to go to shul before you go to the meal. So he's okay. So that was the ruling of the reform rabbi. So that was
that same problem. I got into an argument, well, not an argument, but Rabbi Foster got angry about the Jewish experience because my daughter goes to the Jewish experience as opposed to going to Temple Emanuel for Hebrew school. Mm-hmm. I said, because she didn't get anything out of it and didn't like it, and that's why I switched her, and she loves what she's doing, and I'm not about to put her in Temple just
because you
belong
there. Right.
Yes, and he was angry.
Right, yeah. Right. So there, people can be territorial about their people, etc. Mm-hmm. So, right, so that's an example of a din Torah, how it might work. So the dispute could be about many different things. Could be something like that. It could be straight up monetary dispute. It could be, and as we saw last time, when we talked about paying people on time. Mm-hmm. So it could be that somebody says, I paid you, and the other person says, you didn't pay me. Right, and so then they can bring that to a din Torah too. And if you remember, what did we find? Anybody remember?
About which?
We usually go with the employee, not the employer.
Oh, right, right.
We
pause the employee, right.
The employee
has
a lesser status anyway because he's actually working.
But he's more believed.
He's more trustworthy for if he got his wages or not. We do require him to swear an oath so that he won't lie. Mm-hmm. But he's more trustworthy than the employer because the employer
who might be distracted
or busy or have many employees and just forget who he paid or whatever, whereas the employee remembers if he got his wages or not. So, but that could be another instance of a din Torah. Or let's say you're putting up a fence and somebody says, that's my property. So also din Torah. So you just have, that's what a din Torah is about.
Din Torah is, as opposed to Beit Din. So Din Torah is like one judge or just where you're looking
for? No, I think a Beit Din is the court.
The court,
a Din Torah
okay.
is the trial.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isaac Beshev Zinger has a book of stories. It's called In My Father's Court.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a rabbi in Warsaw, I think. And in his tiny apartment, he held his court.
Right.
Wow.
People would
come. Mm-hmm.
And Zinger, while he was a little boy, he was just eavesdropping. And he wrote a book of stories about, you know,
the things
that
came.
He remembered.
Wow.
Interesting.
It is. I read that a long time ago. I have that on my shelf. It was fascinating to read. Yeah. It was fascinating to read. Yeah, translated from the Yiddish that he wrote.
Husbands, right. And wives, mm-hmm. You know, quarreling, just neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Just the everyday things.
The human tragedy.
Right.
This, like, little tiny thing.
Right,
book.
Right.
But I think it's hard for us.
And that's a single judge.
To, yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's hard for us to imagine the way the communities worked and how, you know, you're right, how just, like,
yeah,
little
it's
things,
just,
you know,
the
they would just, you know, have a little...
They would
yeah.
resolve mm-hmm. their problems. And actually, women would go to the Rebbetzin, the
right.
mother,
mm-hmm.
and sit in the kitchen and talk
and
to her.
And they would talk, and she mm-hmm. would help.
But, mm-hmm. but isn't this what is actually, in fact, going on in really from Orthodox circles in Israel now?
Well, yeah, and even in Denver, depending on... You know, the family. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there could even be, let's just say, like, let's take a modern case, right? Mm-hmm. It could be that there's a dispute between parents and child, let's say in a right-wing family, over college tuition, right? Where the parents feel the child shouldn't go to college. It's not the right environment. And the child feels like, the Talmud says, you're obligated as the parent to educate me to be able to earn my own income. And therefore,
in this day and age,
that requires college, and I feel like you should pay for college, right? Mm-hmm. You have the money, you should pay. It's not like you don't, right? So they might go to the rabbi and have the rabbi adjudicate, mm-hmm. should they, shouldn't they? Right, pay college tuition. Now that's not something you're going to take to a secular court. That really
right.
is, you know.
It's a,
yeah, and the kid's not really
going
to sue his parents for
right.
that, mm-hmm. but it is a like it
moral
needs to be adjudicated.
Ethical.
Yeah, right, right, mm-hmm. and possibly legal, possibly Jewish legal.
Could be.
You know
yeah.
what is that obligation? Because there is an obligation. Parents are required to teach their teach their kids to swim.
Right.
to educate them so they can earn and they can be self-sustaining and to marry them off, to find them a mate. So really
those
it's all about
three.
It's really all about becoming independent. If you think about the metaphor of swimming, that's that
mm-hmm.
you could be thrown into a foreign environment and maintain your own
equilibrium.
Buoyancy
yeah.
and equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that you would be safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that you need to be educated for that. So,
so
I think literally swimming, but also metaphorically swimming. So that you can do that. And certainly, I mean, so it's all about independence. Can you maintain your independence there? Can you maintain your independence in the workplace? Can you become independent as a married person? So those are considered parental obligations. So if they're written about, so then you have to figure out, well, what do they exactly mean? You know, is a parent still required to make sure that a 40-year-old knows how to swim or not? You know, like, what does it mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a rabbi would come in, or you could take somebody to a rabbi. And I think it would happen even in some business things today. And we were just discussing on Shabbos, the inheritance laws require that if the firstborn is a male, that he inherit double.
Just get a double portion.
What everybody else inherits.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think, I'm not positive, but I think only the boys inherit. So
unless there are no boys.
Right, so unless there are no boys, then the girls do, right. So so there's all kinds of ways to fix that up today, to make it equal inheritance. Because you want to follow the Torah law that the boy gets double, but you also want to be fair that the girls should get something or the younger ones. So what you can do is, in Torah law, you can bequeath debt.
I was going to say, oh, okay.
You can bequeath debt. Debt. So you can give your oldest, let's say you have $100,000, right, and six kids. Right, or how would it work? Let's say it's four kids, right?
Yeah.
It's easier
to
do the math that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means that the oldest son gets $40,000 and the other kids get $20,000 each, right? So what you can do is give the oldest son his $40,000, the other one's $20,000 each, but you also give him, let's say, a $7,000 debt to each one of the other kids. So that out of his $40,000
he has to pay them.
Yeah, or whatever the math would make it
yeah,
even.
Right.
So that you can bequeath debt
That's
to him. For them. So he would have to pay them, which would equalize it.
You don't bequeath it to the other children? You have to do it through the eldest?
Well, because he got a double share.
He got the double share.
So she's trying to make it
so
that everybody ends up equally at death.
But why is it on the eldest?
Because
he gets a double share
to start out with. So
right.
he gets more.
Right, if you have
$100,000.
No, it's not his responsibility.
Well,
there's $100,000. There's $100,000. The oldest one gets $40,000. The other three get $20,000. That's Torah law, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they can get nothing, but whatever, he gets double, right? So let's say you're dividing it that way, he gets a double portion. So let's say you're living in, you know, 21st century America and you want everybody to have the same. You want each one to get $25,000, right? Instead of $40,000 and $20,000. So you can't do it that there's four portions of 25. That's breaking Torah law. So you have to figure out how you can do it if you want to do it. So there are ways to do it. That's number
one.
That's
right.
But number two is, should you? You can legally do it. But should you, as an observant Jew, take upon yourself to circumvent the intent of the Torah? If the Torah says the eldest one gets double, eldest one should get double.
But then can you have the discussion about whether things have changed and, you know, I mean, obviously there's all aspects of Torah law that have been, shall we say, interpreted in light of what
today's
reality is.
Right, so the goal is always the same.
Right.
And the means sometimes shift. Like, so for instance, things that would be interpreted, you don't necessarily interpret inheritance law that way. By saying that law was written for a time in which estates were kept together by the eldest son and it had to be passed down to one in bulk so that he could care for the others, and that's the way society was then. And since it's not the way society is today, we should allow inheritance to be different. That's not what you do. Even though that sounds reasonable, because that is saying the Torah was given for a specific time period. And it doesn't apply to today.
Okay.
The way you might interpret would be, let's say, guarding your life very much, right? So there's a principle in the Torah that you have to guard your life, right? So in the 1880s, cigarette smoking was completely acceptable and even promoted because you were sharper. Right. Apparently, I hate to say it, but it seems like people did. I mean, I have a partner in Torah, had a partner in Torah, who gave up smoking. It was so hard for her because she writes. And she said it's just been extremely difficult. She definitely thinks sharper and is more creative when she smokes. Yep, because of the nicotine, it's really hard.
Well, it's probably everything else. It's a drug and it affects people.
Yeah, it does. Apparently, it does sharpen the brain while it dulls the body. So in the 1880s, it would be fine. It did not break Torah law to smoke in the 1880s. Where it changed was when we understood how dangerous it was to the body. The law, guard your body, stays the same. What changed was our understanding of what cigarettes do to the body, which meant that the law now has to be not reinterpreted, but understood that the law is guard your body. Now we see this hurts your body. You can't smoke anymore. So it's not a reinterpretation. It is an understanding of a change in reality.
So what you're saying is if something is concretized, as in give the eldest son a double share.
It's not estates together, let's
right,
say.
Right, exactly.
It's not what it is.
No, it doesn't say, preserve your property. So it's concretized. It's a specific thing.
Right.
Then
that's what it says to do. That's what it's supposed to do.
But you interpret it in the light of 21st century.
She's saying no, not exactly.
Well, but...
She's saying not really. She's saying if it's concretized, don't.
But there's a living Torah which applies to today. So
that's why I gave those two examples. Yeah. If it says something specific, like give the eldest son double, then you give the eldest son double. It didn't say, we're thinking of principles of why maybe to do that. So then we're shifting that around. Why should the Torah say that? Possibly to keep estates together. Well, today it's different, so maybe we should do different. That's not it. The Torah says give the eldest son double, so you give him double. Period. You can figure out how to circumvent that, but should you? But that's different than something like guard your body.
Yeah, well, that I understand. But I'm interested more in this whole thing with inheritance. That's very, very tricky.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Well, it's a question of what,
It would be much easier if all the kids are on the same page and disagree with
them. if what you could do would be to take care of it during your lifetime.
Right, you could do that.
By gifting virtually everything so
I think
you end
you
up
do
with
that.
Nothing.
Yeah.
That's the solution. You basically gift it during your life, which is not then contravening the Torah obligation.
Right. Or you can
might be circumventing, but it's not contravening.
Or you can do. I have friends who are in their probably late 70s, early 80s. They're on the ski plan. I said, the ski plan, what's that? Spend kids' inheritance.
That was my parents' thought. My parents had the idea they earned it, they should spend it. And
that's
they
right.
did.
Travel around the world, do what they want.
I'm
the
in
ski
favor
plan.
Of that.
So, So there's that. But so so inheritance is something else to look at.
Okay.
Interestingly, sometimes it's a
whole other
thing.
Probably.
But the concept is that the Torah set it up so that things work. We don't always understand how or why, and sometimes it doesn't look nice to us. Mm. You know, so it could be that we go through different time periods where it doesn't work with our sensibilities. So let's just say, and I just think it's interesting, we'll have to see in 50 years what the story is, but homosexuality today. So I just read an article by Steven Greenberg, the openly gay Orthodox rabbi, quote unquote. Right, so he did a commitment ceremony for two men under a chuppah, so I saw a picture of it. And he believes that clergy of compassion will continue to do such ceremonies. And just because you're Orthodox doesn't mean that you're not gay, that sexual orientation is not up to you. And so we do understand, I mean, the traditional point of view is, yes, sexual orientation is not up to you, but how you behave is up to you. And so traditionally, we understand the Torah asks people who have a sexual orientation that attracts them to the same sex to be celibate. Just like we ask single people, just like we ask widows, just like we ask whatever it is, you know, that once you don't have a kosher partner, you don't get to have sex. So, so he says that's not right, that sexuality is too big to deny, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, we'll see, you know, that's reinterpreting something. And he wants to reinterpret it, and he has. He has a whole book on the reinterpretation of those verses, because it's extremely clear in the Torah, not allowed to lie with a man. A man can't lie with a man, so that's extremely clear. It can't be really reinterpreted to mean that it can't, except for he has a whole book on how he reinterprets it.
He has.
Right, so he's reinterpreted it. But that's not the opinion of halacha. So the question is, what do we do with stuff like that, stuff that we don't like? You know, I will give one more example of interpretation and reinterpretation, which is not really reinterpretation, and that is, let's say, organ donation. Right, so save a life, don't take a life. Those are two important principles, right? Save a life and don't take a life. So 40 years ago, let's say 50 years ago, let's just go with 40, when organ donation was possible, but we did not have the kind of communication that we have today, right? But it could save a life. So in a hospital where a person was dying who needed that organ, and a person had just died who had that organ, it was halachically permissible to take the organ from the dead person and put it in the person who needed it. But it wasn't permissible because even at that time, 40 years ago, you could preserve an organ for a short period of time. So when somebody would die, they would want to take the organs and then see if somebody needed it.
You couldn't do that.
Couldn't do that
because
it wasn't saving a life. It was maybe we might save a life.
But
so you're
you weren't
desecrating
taking
the dead,
a life.
You're desecrating the dead body.
I see. By
to maybe save a life.
I see.
But you might not.
Good.
But now we have enough communication to know that
so
there's
that
a guy
know,
in Arizona
right.
who needs that now.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, while the dying guy is on the operating table, the helicopter is landing.
Waiting. Waiting
yeah,
for the guy.
Waiting for that. When the other guy in Arizona is being prepped
right.
so that he's open and ready by the time that helicopter lands and it's in. So it is pikuach nefesh. It is saving a life
now.
All around the country. Yes, now. So now, okay, so that's permitted to take it out. But now still the question is, so now
what's
we
dead?
Know more.
Now it's like, what's dead? That's the question now.
What's dead?
Right.
What's dead? Is it brain or is it heart? That's a question. And because of medical technology, we didn't know what was dead. I mean, the Torah answer to what's dead is heart cessation, which is past brain. So now we're in flux right now. Not because the halacha has changed, because we're not quite sure what death is today. So our traditional definition of death is being challenged. So some people are pulling back and saying, no, the Torah definition of death is heart cessation.
Stopping.
And some people are saying, no, we understand that death really, there is no going back from brain death. That is dead. But the heart may still be beating, which means that the heart is still usable.
Or
so if the heart
would stop by itself, but you keep it beating.
Right, right. Because
I mean, that's
still
even
organs.
More, that's even the next
so
step.
So lungs and livers and hearts can be taken at that point, and they can't be after the heart stops beating.
Right, because then there's no blood supply to
right.
them.
Right, so
then
it's halachic questions. You know, are you taking the life? Are you saving a life? Are you wasting a life? For you, right? So that's all territory that's being judged, but not because the halacha's changed, right? Because we are now understanding death differently. Mm-hmm. So it will take a while for the halacha to catch up because people are nervous about letting go of an old definition of death. but still it has to be dead, right? So that's evolving, but it's not reinterpretation.
So what is the current?
Depends about who you ask, I think.
That's the current position. It's controversy.
You know, it just reminded me, because when my dad died, and I was completely illiterate, you know, it was before I started even remotely educating myself. It was just, to me, it was just so shocking, because as soon as, you know, it happened in the hospital here, they were already asking, like, can we take
corneas and all kinds of things older people.
For probably just for studies, which is, you know, I understand that eventually it will lead to saving somebody's life, but I was just, I just couldn't even imagine. I said, no, absolutely not, just go away, people. Just
right.
Don't.
Right. And that's actually more of a problem. For studies is a problem, because it's not immediately saving a life. Mm-hmm. So we don't.
And when you're older, it's like there's not very much they can really use.
Right, so that's not what they're interested in. So Jewishly, we do it to save a life, but not for research that will lead to saving lives. So I'm not, you know, a medical ethicist, and this stuff is changing regularly.
There's a ton of stuff
on all of this.
If you went online, I'm sure you could read forever.
Yeah, you really could. You really could. Rabbi Akiva Tatz has a book on this kind of stuff, which will be out of date at some point. You know, like, certainly on the
probably
end of life
soon.
Issues, yeah. But there's also stuff on, let's say, on in vitro fertilization and fertility things and, like, all kinds of things where there's evolving medical realities that impact on age-old halachic realities. So you have to learn how to pull those rulings out of ancient texts where those medical realities didn't exist, and yet the halachic principles remain the same. The legal principles remain the same. So, okay. So is that the difference between interpretation and shifting realities? It's two different things. Okay.
So you had done the chaf.
Okay, good. Thank you. Refocusing. Okay. So in this principle that we should judge fairly, and that everyone who is educated and honest is required to be a judge if they're asked, is also the concept that each one of us will be judging. So maybe not in a trial. However, we do judge. And so in this principle is, let's see, on the bottom of page 67, in what we said too, that every man is obligated to judge his fellow favorably toward the side of merit, which is included in the sense of the precept. In this lies a reason for peace and friendship among people. Thus we find that the main point of the purposes of this precept is to provide benefit for the settled communal life of human beings by the upright honesty of the law, and to spread peace among them by the removal of one man's suspicion of another. Mm-hmm. So judging fairly, but then each one of us actually has to judge more than fairly, or the definition of judging fairly is to judge to the side of benefit. That we should always give somebody the benefit of the doubt. So, and that's an important concept. We personally will be happier if we do that, because we feel less taken advantage of. Right? It was interesting. I'm trying to think how I could say this without.
Well, there's that great example of seeing a real Orthodox rabbi in a McDonald's.
Right.
And thinking, oh, look at this.
Look at this,
rabbi.
What a Sean does.
What a terrible thing. That turns out later that he was a diabetic and he needed to stop in and get
a Coke or something
to save his life. So if you had judged him, you know, previously.
Right, if you judge him fairly, right. Yeah. Right, judge him to the side of benefit. Yeah. Right, so I, for instance, saw in somebody's home something that I had brought from a store out of state. So I was thinking, how did it get in their home? Somebody, I don't want to give too many details. Anyway, so I was busy thinking, I can't believe they came and they took that. And I was saying, you know, really, I'm totally not judging fairly. I should just ask the person where they found that in Colorado. You know, like, it's possible.
As opposed to assuming that they helped themselves.
Right. You know, I should ask where did they find that. It's possible that maybe in
somebody else,
a closeout place or whatever, Tuesday morning, they had some of that stuff.
Or
who
somebody
knows?
Else had gotten it and given it to them
or
whatever.
Right, who knows. But that would be an example of judging favorably. So it's not easy to do that. I'll tell you one of my favorite stories of this. I read this in Rebbetzin Yehuda Sammet's book, The Other Side of the Story. So the whole book is about judging people favorably. So she gives an example of a wedding that somebody went to, and the whole ceremony goes on, and they, you know, and the bride and the groom, you know, go into the seclusion room and come out, and there's no photographer anywhere. And finally, in the middle of dancing, a photographer runs in, sweaty, in street clothes, sets up a ladder, and starts taking pictures. And somebody's watching this thinking, I can't believe that photographer was so late. Missed the whole ceremony, and look how he's dressed. Disgusting. Right? And that person's watching and thinking, and she's making a wedding in a couple of months. So in a few months later, she's thinking, I need a photographer. I'm not going to hire that guy. No way. Right? So she calls up her friend who made the wedding and said, you know, do you have any suggestions for photographers? Because I
thought that one.
Joe, the photographer at your wedding was terrible. I can't believe you came in so late and missed it. She said, no, the photographer that we hired, Schmo the photographer, didn't show up. Joe's our friend. He was playing golf, and I called him in a panic that Schmo didn't show up. And he dropped everything, and he ran. He didn't even have a chance to change his clothes, and he just grabbed his stuff and his ladder, and he came in. At least we got pictures of the dancing. We're so thankful to Joe the photographer for catching at least the end of the wedding, or we would have had no pictures at all. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you hear the other side of the story, it pays sometimes just to ask. What, rather than think, I can't believe Joe the photographer is so disgusting, just say, well, what happened at the wedding with your photographer? Just ask. Sometimes it pays to.
That's probably always good advice. Mm-hmm.
I had an experience where I'm trying to teach my son the benefit of the doubt thing, and forgive me because I'm not an Obama supporter, so you have to forgive me for this. But the other day I was in the parking lot at King Super. I came back out, and this car had parked next to me, this little red Volvo older station wagon. And on the back of it, I was aghast. It said Obama 2012. And I just went, oh, I can't believe it. I can't deal with this. Everything. So I had to go home and call him and say, but you can't believe it. I saw my first, you know. And I said, however, I said, what I thought was, this was a young mother. I looked down in the car to see who is in this car. So there was this young mother and two little kids in the back seat. And I said, I thought to myself, now if I said anything to her, what I would say is, did you just purchase this car?
Oh, good. Maybe it wasn't her sticker.
And if, you know, and she would probably say to me, no, why would you ask that? Because I can't believe you got that sticker. You put that sticker in. But I mean, I said, that's what you have to think about. Maybe she just purchased that car for somebody to change the car.
She said, forgive. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion.
Right, that's what I said, forgive me.
Just giving an example.
Yes. Well, we were just in Israel. We just got back on the 4th. And we were all over Jerusalem, and a lot of very obviously rabbi-looking men with the beards and the hats and everything were all smoking. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, who's 10, she said to me, Mommy, why are all the rabbis smoking? You know, smoking is so bad for you.
And, good question.
Yeah, and it's hard. You know, you don't want to, like, judge them, and you don't want to give her, you know. And I was right. Like, I don't know why they're smoking.
Right. So that's an answer. And also an answer is smoking is a very powerful addiction, and some people get addicted the very first time they try it. So don't try it, honey. Because some people do get addicted the first time they try
it. It's a cultural thing, too.
But it's a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. And also they don't understand really how bad it is for you. Really. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's also, I mean, as she gets a little bit older, you can talk about cognitive dissonance, too. People lie to themselves like crazy that this isn't so bad, or one doesn't make a difference, or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Just like people do with weight and calories and exercise and sleep and all that stuff, people lie like crazy to themselves, right? Everybody needs 8 hours of sleep. I only need 6, and therefore it's safe for me to drive on sleep deficit.
How many people have said that? But
you know it's right. Not right.
So, oh, I don't need that much sleep.
Right. So people do that all the time. So cognitive dissonance is something important to discuss as a kid gets older. And you can say, just because somebody is working in some areas of their lives doesn't mean that they've achieved in every area of their lives. And also in Israel, just because they look like that doesn't mean they're a rabbi. Mm-hmm. And doesn't mean they're spiritually worked out. You know, people dress according to their groups. So in Israel, there's groups that have uniforms and they're wearing it.
Right.
So that's important to understand, too. Mm-hmm. Which is not something they necessarily understand there. Here, people are a little bit more cognizant that if they're wearing a uniform, they better represent. But not everybody does. I'll just give you one for instance. We had some fringe guy in our West Side neighborhood, not Jewish, who lived in Lakewood, just over the border, who was a Messianic Jew, meaning he's a Christian.
Right, right.
who thought of himself as Jewish, and he dressed like a Hasid. Socks, payas,
really? Sitzes
out, and he worked at Ace Hardware on Saturdays.
Well, it was perfectly right? consistent with his beliefs.
So what are you supposed to think? What are you supposed to think? You're checking out, and you're thinking, oh, this guy works on Saturdays. He's wearing the whole uniform, right? So you should think, if you happen to be encountering that person, okay, right. Jews don't work on Saturdays. This guy is. So either he's not Jewish, or he's meshuggah, or he completely rejects the Torah, and he's trying to make people look bad by wearing these clothes, you know, like, but you can't think, you should not think a Jew is breaking the Sabbath. Right, so there are different chusim. There's different positive things you could think. Even that somebody's crazy is more positive than somebody's right. breaking Shabbos on purpose. Mm-hmm. You know.
Do you remember that terrible crime? An Orthodox Jew killed a boy,
mm-hmm. oh, yeah.
and
yeah.
they showed him right. in the court. He wasn't wearing kippah.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, thank God.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he shouldn't. But he was crazy.
Yeah, he was.
Is.
Yeah. He was.
Was is. Yeah. Yeah.
Is right. Wasn't yeah. that long ago.
Yeah. So, right. So that brings us to the next one, 236, the prohibition on gossiping.
What a segue!
Right?
What a segue!
So I think it's a perfect segue because one of the reasons why we gossip is because we have failed to judge somebody to the benefit, right? So then we have what to say. Can you believe so and so did whatever? Because meanwhile you're judging away, right? You see somebody, well, I don't know, with a shiny new pair of diamond earrings, and you can't believe that they didn't give to your charity with a look at what they're wearing, and you didn't really even think that TJ Maxx has a beautiful CZ earrings for $20 in sterling.
By the way, that's what these are.
They're lovely.
That's before anybody makes any judgments.
So it's very easy for people to judge, you know, and think about things like that, too. And then they're all mad, and they're starting to talk about how that person wastes money, and they don't even give to tzedakah, and look how much they have, and obviously they're not giving. And, you know, so that's because we didn't give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they inherited them. Maybe they're family pieces. Maybe they inherited them on the condition that they could never give them away, whatever it is, or sell them. You know, you don't know what it is, if they're real, if they're fake, if they're, you know. You have no clue, so you have no right to judge. So, I do want to just go back for 1 second to this one before I forgot to say this. This is important. When judging fairly, you're supposed to give favor not in judgment but in earliness of the case to widows and orphans. So, and women. So let's say you have a whole docket, right, a whole day long full of cases. You should judge the women, the widows, and the orphans first because they're more vulnerable. They're going to get more nervous. It's not about giving them favor in the judgment. You have to judge them fairly. But you should judge them as soon as you can so that they don't have that time to get extra butterflies and extra nervous because they're extra vulnerable and they'll think they're not going to be judged fairly. So you should take care of that right away. If possible.
That's interesting.
Triage, yeah. Triage in the courtroom.
Right.
Nice.
Right. I think that's nice, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nice. Orphans and widows and women first. right. Okay, so on gossiping slanderously. So this is
the
called...
The difference between a woman and a widow.
There's a big difference, actually. So a woman could be married, could be single.
No,
right?
I know, but I'm just saying women, orphans, and widows. I mean,
widows
the widow
are
is going to be a woman.
Right, a widow is going to be a woman, right, but it's a different type of vulnerability.
I see, okay.
Right,
okay.
I mean, you have a husband, so you're in the world, even though you're your own person.
Or whatever,
but there is a protection there, there's somebody you could bounce ideas off. There's not the vulnerability of being alone, you know, and being... Whether you're being judged by a neighbor or you're afraid somebody's going to encroach on your property, and who are you going to turn to defend you? You know, even if you have enough money to eat and to live, but you might not. I mean, I just spoke to somebody who, I'm not sure if she's a widow or divorced, but in her early 60s, an RN who called me. She's looking for a job. She doesn't have anything. And so here she is without, you know, she's without a protector in that sense. And I mean, it's a bad economy. It could be a couple also that doesn't have enough to eat, but... I think for a woman who had a man who's now without a man, she could feel extra vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So that's why widow is different than women. Okay. Shelo l'Rachel, that's this one, 236, the prohibition of gossiping slanderously. So we talked about why that follows. So Rachel, oh, interesting. In this, the actual message is lo l'Ragel. I wonder why that is.
So it is.
Well, I think that might be a typo.
You think it could be a typo?
It's
as opposed to a...
Because the mitzvah is...
No,
so I'm just looking at
the
Hebrew
the
right here. Lola Rachel.
Okay.
Ragel.
Lola Ragel. So that's not to... Maybe. It's Lo Telech Rachel is the pasuk, is the verse. Do not... you shall not go about as a tale bearer. So that I would think it would be Lo Lerachel. You know, not to say Rachilus. Rachilut. But it could be not to walk leragel, to walk out, because this is tail bearing,
leg, right?
So. Right. So tail bearing means you should not be walking around telling, peddling. A rochel is somebody who a peddler. So you should not peddle stories about others. You shouldn't be the kind of person who brings stories. So a gossip monger, right? That's what we say in English. My grandmother had these napkins that said, "I never repeat gossip." So listen carefully the first time.
Okay.
So repeating gossip. So what is that gossiping? Right. So gossiping is about creating connections among people that are based on the negative things of others. Right. That's what gossiping in general is. And that's why people like to gossip. They like to have the goods and share the goods. There's some kind of power in having the goods, having the secret, or having the information, even if it's not a secret, and sharing it, all right? Which is why we like to share a mazel tov. You know, it's so exciting to be the one who gets to call and say, "Did you hear
so-and-so's
engaged
or pregnant
or
whatever?"
Right, we like to do that. But some, unfortunately, in that same area of like is you want to be able to call and say, "Did you hear so-and-so got arrested, so-and-so whatever, can't believe them," you know. So, because you want, it is a human desire to have that power position of being able to share the information, and then the sense of a superiority, even maybe trust, depending if it develops trust or erodes it. But creating connections through negativity. So, this particular mitzvah is about rechilut, tail bearer, but it includes lashon hara altogether. Lashon hara, evil tongue or evil speech, lashon hara. Lashon is tongue. It's lashon, which is the same word in Yiddish. Lashon also means language. So like we say
lashon
in Yiddish,
kodesh.
The mama lashon, lashon kodesh, right? Or the mama lashon, right? Your mother tongue. So it's a language. So lashon hara is evil language, evil speech altogether. So that's a wide category, but it's one of those words that works in wide and narrow. So just like we have Torah, for instance, which is wide, it can be what we're studying now, we're learning Torah, or it can be narrow, it's the five books, right? So it's the five books of Torah, or anything about Jewish law and concepts is Torah, right? So the same thing with Lashon Hara. So Lashon Hara is all evil speech, all forbidden speech, all of it, or it also has, Lashon Hara has its own specific category, which is true negative things about somebody. True negative things. So it would not include lying. It would not include incitement. It would not include rechilut, which we'll talk about. Lashon hara is true negative things.
Now that, for example,
in the narrow definition,
if you know someone that's about to go into a business deal with someone else, and you know that this person has in the past, you know, gone bankrupt or had bad connections, you are obligated.
Right. That's lashon hara litoelet.
Okay.
For good.
For a positive, constructive purpose.
All right.
So you are permitted to say negative things for a positive, constructive purpose. Okay. There's all kinds of laws about it, and it would be interesting to someday do a very long, I mean, it would be years-long study of it, and everybody can do it online, too. There's all kinds of, the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation has emails that they send out on a daily basis with just like a few sentences or one paragraph every day on the laws of proper speech. So that's something to just, it takes a long time to learn it and a long time to review it, but it has to be constantly reviewed. It's easily forgotten. So we want to constantly go back over that. But positive constructive purpose, so it has, there's all kinds of laws about it. It has to be, what you say has to be absolutely true and necessary and firsthand information. So you can't know from your friend that they went bankrupt and you just tell your friend, your other friend who's going into business. You can't know from Sally that Reuven went bankrupt, and now you're telling Shimon that Reuven once went bankrupt. You don't know. You weren't there, right? But if you were in business with him, and he stole from you, or you're pretty sure he stole from you, then you are permitted to, and he's about to go into a business partnership, then you're permitted and required, then, in that case, to go, but only say what's true. You can't say, That Shimon, he's such a gunov. I can't believe you're going into business with him. He steals every chance he gets. He's so dishonest. You can only say you know, I noticed on a regular basis that we were $20 short in the till, and it happened to be the days that he closed the shop. You don't know for sure if he stole. You're just pretty sure. But then you are permitted to say that. On the days that he closed, we were $20 short on a regular, but I was never able to prove it. You could say that. Mm-hmm. Or you could even say we had a business dispute and we had a din Torah, and it was judged that he did steal that $500. You could say that.
If it were true.
If it were true, right. And you have firsthand information. But you can only say that. You can't say, you can't add on to it, you shouldn't go into business with him because he stole from me. All you can say is, I heard you're going into business with him, or considering
Here's
it.
My experience.
I would like to share my experience with you. That's it. No judgments. You can just share your straight-up experience with no exaggeration.
I think this is like one of the very hardest things.
So hard.
I mean, it's something that I catch myself on all the time.
So
I mean,
hard.
Just even casual conversation.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's like you're like, wait a minute, what did I say? I can't believe I just said that.
Right, and so difficult, especially when you're processing. Well, I'll just give you, for instance, let's say as mom of teens, let's say you're processing your own issues around your child rearing with your friend. But that includes speaking Lashon Hara about your children. Are you allowed to do that?
Thought about
right?
that.
No,
oh my
right?
gosh, I never even thought about that. Oh!
So, yeah, it's a whole big deal.
It gets longer.
And,
no kidding.
So is this the seminal mitzvah for Lashon Hara?
This is definitely one of the big ones. There's a few other ones, like not hating your brother in your heart and all kinds of things. But I think this is the main one in terms of actually speaking it out, yeah,
okay.
To not speak rechilut. Now, this includes all Lashon Hara, but rechilut specifically, or rechilus, is also its own category with under the large umbrella of Lashon Hara. And that is the specific type of saying it's a triangle, not two people. So it's not me telling you that so-and-so ate treif. That would be Lashon Hara, right? But it's me telling you me telling you what Sally said about you.
Oh.
Okay.
I was talking to Sally the other day, and she said, you are such a snob. Right? She said it. It's true. But it's not even, if I'll tell you, Sally is such a snob, and it's true, that's Lashon Hara, which will cause you to respect her less. Probably me less, too, for saying it, but will cause you to respect her less, but won't cause you to hate her.
But
if I tell you, that's Sally, can you believe what she said? She said, you're such a snob, right? That's going to cause you to hate her or to be very angry with
her.
Angry
with the messenger.
Right?
Like, don't kill the messenger.
Right. So it creates... sometimes a person shares it to create a connection. Can you believe what she said? That's so disgusting. You know, I mean, and it's so not right what she said. Right. We're friends, and look at how she treats you. That's why I'm telling you, to create the connection between us about how terrible she is about you. Right? So people do that, right? But that, of course, undermines peaceful relations among community members, and it's completely forbidden. You're not permitted to do that. One of the reasons is because people do vent. That's human nature. And they say not nice things about others. So, and they might not say that not nice thing in front. Sally might not go over to Marilyn and say, you're such a snob.
Directly.
She might not say it because she doesn't want to have that much of a breach in the relationship. And she might just be venting. And so it's up to us, the hearer of that, to protect the speaker who shouldn't have said it.
And the about-er,
you know, who definitely shouldn't hear it. But then we become entrusted really with the godly thing to do, which is to protect the relationships in our community and refrain from sharing that at all. If we can correct Sally from saying that, that's good. And if we can't, we should at least keep it under our hats and we don't share it at all. You know, nobody needs to hear that. But just the only reason for sharing that is to create bad relations. Unless there's a safety issue, right? Unless Sally is employed, right, by you or something, and she says, you know, that boss of mine, she's such a snob, she always thinks she knows, I'm going to show her, you know. She thinks she knows, when she places the order for those clothes from France for her store, I'm going to order them from Poland. You know?
Whoa!
Okay, then you could share.
Hmm. I think we just detected a little bit of
Well, have you seen Polish clothes? Have you seen French clothes?
Are you kidding me? Yes.
Everybody's entitled
to
their... Right. Everybody's entitled to their
exactly.
sense of style.
Yeah.
Polish, Russian, quite similar. I mean, styles are very similar, yeah. So anyway.
I was in Russia. I dreamed of Polish.
So step up, huh? Okay.
Right.
There's a bunch of, there's a bunch of little
good.
Kids out here. They're so cute.
Good. They're having
kids.
Fun.
They're so cute. There
so,
must be a playroom next door.
Right. Oh, the preschool is in this building over here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. They're going in and out like crazy.
Right. Okay. So anyway, so this concept of not being a tail, not using our power of speech to destroy, right? That's really the root of it, is that we were created in the image of God, and God chose to create the world through speech. He didn't have to. He could have created the world however he wanted. He's God. You know, he could have done the I Dream of Jeannie, I Blink, or the Bewitched Nose Twitch, or the Harry Potter Magic Wand, or whatever else he wanted to. He could have just thought it into existence, whatever it was. But he chose to use speech. Let there be, let there be. There's 10 speeches, 10 phrases, addresses that bring the world into being. But he chose that specifically to create speech as a pathway for creation. So, and then he gave us speech and made us like him, so that we can now use speech to create, or the converse. So we have to have laws around it that say, don't use speech for destruction. Speech is for creation. Speech is for bonding. So, and speech does bond. If you think about it, also, speech is one of those things, like food, that moves from inside to outside. So food, we take from outside and put inside, right, through the mouth. And speech, we go from the inside and we put it outside. So it is something that connects our insides to our outsides. So that's why we have laws around food, kosher food, to connect in a holy way with the outside and the inside, and kosher speech to connect in a holy way with the inside going to the outside. So, and in order for speech does express our insides, which is why it's preceded by the mitzvah to judge favorably. We want our insides to be in check, so that it shouldn't be that our lips, which we have two of, right, are supposed to be a gateway. It shouldn't be that we just prevent ourselves from speaking poorly by keeping our mouth shut, which is a way to do it. We just keep our lips closed, we won't say bad things. It really should, and that is step one, but really it should be from the inside that we don't think those bad things so that they won't come out. Right, so that's where the judging favorably comes from. First you judge favorably, and then there's nothing negative to say, right? Because it's you're anyway in a place of peace, in a place of recognition of the humanity of every person.
It's like a lifetime duty.
It is a lifetime
job
exercise. It really is.
And there's so many situations where you are in the presence of people that are speaking Lashon Hara.
Right.
And, you know, you don't know what to do. You either try to turn the conversation, or sometimes you have to just walk away.
Yeah, you do something that's leave. Yes.
Because
that's what it says here, and it's important just to, we'll end on this, or just this thought, that yes, three people are harmed. The one who is speaking harms their soul. The one who is being spoken about, of course, their reputation is harmed. And the one who hears it, right? They are harmed by listening. So, and according to the Sefer Chinuch, that's the one who's harmed the most, is the one who receives it. So we have to be very careful, for sure in our speech, but also in our listening. And so we can daven every day, please Hashem, help me judge people favorably, speak appropriately, and not hear inappropriate speech. That's level one. But if at least we say that every day, that request, then we our antennas are up a little bit more. But it is so difficult. And I've really learned from my mother, who's so good at this, to say, I think this conversation is Lashon Hara. Let's talk about something else. Now, she can do that. Mm-hmm. I find it extremely difficult to do that. But, I mean, we could say, let's talk about something else. And sometimes you can do it. Or you could just say, let's talk about a different subject. Or let's move from people to weather, whatever it is. Or if you're on the phone, it's easier. You can just say, oh, gotta go, you know, whatever it is. And you can hang up. But
or you can do what Bob does. How about those Broncos?
Right, right. He's good.
The minute it starts, that's what he says. How about those Broncos?
Right.
And that usually will start a conversation for sure, and especially today.
Right, right. And they do very well last night. Mm-hmm. I know my husband who never goes.
I didn't go Duke went. I didn't want to go.
My husband never goes to games, but somebody invited him yesterday and he went and he came back.
It was
and,
like,
and I was thinking, like, he doesn't even watch 5 minutes of, like, back in the day when we watched Johnny Carson and there was 5 minutes of sports before that. He did not watch it. So he's so not a sports guy. He came in from the game, and I said, how's the game? He's like, it was really good. I was like, are you joking? Like, I couldn't tell. Is he teasing me? Like, is
oh,
this
no,
my
I
husband?
Think, I think
he's
it
like,
was
no, it really was good.
I think that it was one of those things where the feelings in the stadium were palpable. Mm-hmm. And so people who were yeah. there just felt totally... Yeah. I mean, that's what
yeah.
I wasn't
yeah.
there, but
no,
I think
he said
what,
it was great. I was shocked you know, that he cared, so. But... Anyway, so our goal is to use our mouth, our words, our thoughts to create shalom, not to create distance. So
what a good thing to end on. And no class next.